Welcome to Parenting a Child with Learning Difficulties. My name is Sarah Dimmerman, also known as Help Me Sarah, and I'm joined today by Dr. Helena Zeideman. Over the next little while, we're going to chat about the issues and details related to parenting a child with a learning difficulty. Hi, Helena.
Hi.
I'd like to begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am a psychologist with the Toronto District School Board. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, and I have worked with children, adolescents, families, teachers, schools for about the past 18 years.
Wonderful. Thank you. So you're going to bring to us a wealth of information, I know.
And I
know you and I have worked together before, so I know that I can count on you to help the listeners with what they need to know.
Thank you.
So perhaps we could begin by just talking a little bit about how a parent might initially decide, or what might be some of the warning signs or the early signs that would signal to a parent that perhaps their child has a learning difficulty.
Okay, I mean, it can be quite complicated in some ways. Typically, I think your best source of information is your child's classroom teacher, especially in the younger grades where they spend, you know, the majority of their day with one teacher. That teacher can obviously see the development of the core academic skills compared to other children of the same age. So if something isn't developing at the rate that would be expected, either the literacy or the numeracy skills, reading and math, written language, then the classroom teacher can often provide parents with some insight. Other signs might be a child who seems to understand everything, can talk about it, and has come home and is able to talk to you about what they've learned, whether it's about the solar system or pioneer days or anything that's conceptual, but yet really struggles with some of the very core skills such as learning to read, learning to decode, having great difficulty understanding math concepts, number facts, having significant difficulties putting their thoughts on paper. Sometimes their oral language seems so strong and so articulate, and their written language is so much different from that, where there's really a very significant difference between their oral and their written language.
So you're talking about that difference, like you notice contradictions almost?
Well, you'd see a discrepancy, like especially, I mean, obviously, you know, grade ones and grade twos aren't writing is a developmental skill that takes time to develop. But sometimes you see in a little bit more in the upper grades, children who are extremely articulate and their written language just doesn't reflect that.
Mm-hmm. So they may be able to, as you said, describe something in vivid detail, but then when they actually need to put pen to paper, they have a difficult time formulating. Would it be about formulating the ideas, or is it also about just even the being able to write it down?
It could be, because sometimes it can be almost at a fine motor level, or, you know, what some of their printing skills, it could be almost at that level, or their organization, or their ability to just, you know, to pay attention to spelling and capitals and punctuation and sentence structure and organizing your thoughts is such a multiple complex task that it can be very difficult for kids to hold that all in sort of active memory and get that job done.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, I agree with you that the classroom teacher is probably your best source of information, but how early might a parent be able to pick this up? Because might it be picked up as early as JK, for example?
It could be. I mean, it's hard to say because most skills start to, you know, be taught at that grade. Sometimes if there's a strong family history, sometimes you have an earlier sense that something is maybe not, you know, going as expected in terms of the development of the skill. Sometimes it's a little bit easier for, you know, the second or third child of the family. It's harder with the first because you've never seen the skill develop before. You're just sort of learning with your child. Sometimes parents have said to me, well, he's certainly not learning to read the way his older sister did.
Right.
And so they see that. And I mean, while there is always danger in comparing your children, sometimes it's a bit of a red flag that I need to pay a little bit more attention.
Yeah.
The kid's young, but sometimes you do see it if it's a more profound difficulty, like really significant difficulty in learning their letters, learning their colors, learning to recognize numbers. Sometimes you can see it that early. Typically, it isn't that. That's a bit on the early side. Usually, it's grade one, grade two, maybe a little bit more typical.
So, working within the school board, I know that if a teacher recognizes that there's a discrepancy or that there appears to be some kind of learning difficulty, that teacher may make then a referral, correct? They may request some kind of an assessment within the school board?
They may, and every board probably functions a little bit differently. I certainly know the way that, you know, the board that I work for tends to function. And again, sometimes it can even be specific to a certain school. But typically, the teacher will go and talk and request some support, either maybe from within the school, from the special education teacher. They might start with that, some additional support within the school. And if that doesn't work after a certain period of time, then they may look for some additional assessment result, be it potentially it could be obviously psychological assessments if that's the nature of the referral, or it might be a speech and language assessment or an occupational therapy assessment. So they would look to get further information through the resources available that way.
And what if, you know, sometimes I'll be approached by parents who are really struggling to get the school to acknowledge what they're seeing. And they also know that even if they went through the school, there might be a long wait period and they don't really want to wait. So what would be their options then?
It's true. Some schools do absolutely have very long waiting lists, and bigger schools obviously probably have bigger waiting lists too. And sometimes the parent prefers to do it outside of the school so that they can sort of have it done in a more timely fashion if that's what they're able to do. Often there are private psychologists in private practice who offer that kind of service. There are many psychologists certainly in the greater Toronto area that provide that. And sometimes there are various agencies, community agencies or you know, mental health agencies that provide that kind of service as well.
And that kind of service, if somebody has extended health insurance, would often be covered in part or full by that insurance, correct?
In part or full. From my experience, the people's extended health benefits vary greatly, and before you enter into some, you know, private arrangement, it's best to check with your insurance provider and see what your coverage is.
And a lot of parents are concerned about having an assessment because they're afraid that their child will be stigmatized or that the results will be placed in the Ontario student record that follows the child from school to school. What are the parameters around that? Like, if a parent had a private assessment, could they then decide if they wanted to put that assessment into the file?
Oh, absolutely. Even if they had an assessment done with their local board, they could absolutely decide whether or not they wanted that assessment in the Ontario student record.
They could request that it be removed if they didn't want it in there.
They always ask for it to be sent back to their local psychological services department or their school board.
Uh-huh. But, you know, and I know that there's, I know for most parents, you know, receiving a diagnosis of a learning disability, the word disability, I think, is difficult sometimes to swallow anyway. But sometimes receiving that is so troublesome for parents that they don't want, as you said, like any indication of that being acknowledged. But my experience and what I really encourage parents against is just making a quick decision about that, because I find that sometimes if the school isn't aware of the disability or the difficulty, then they're actually doing their child a disservice sometimes. Would you agree?
I would say so. And I mean, I hear this, you know, on a very frequent basis from parents that they're concerned that information may be misused or misinterpreted. And I have to say that has not been traditionally my experience. I mean, I find teachers very welcoming of the information, very, very happy to get additional supports and insights into how to best support that child in his or her learning. I have found that schools tend to do the best job they can for the students, and they work well towards, when they have the information, they work better. I what I often tell parents is that the teacher knows that there's something not going as well as might be expected. They may not know why, and they may not know how to help, but you're not hiding anything from them, really. They know something's not going easily for that child.
Yeah.
To sort of deprive them of the information that they could use doesn't make sense to me.
Now, just as a question, you know, we think about, when we talk about learning difficulties, I mean, I think about academic difficulties, like as you said, with numbers or with literacy. And I know that part of an assessment may include looking at whether a child is at grade level academically. But then there's also looking at the overall intelligence of the child, using the Wechsler Intelligence Scale for children, which we call the WISC, and looking at their overall IQ, and looking, as you said, about the discrepancy between their verbal and their nonverbal skills and that kind of thing. Could you explain a little bit more about what kind of tests may be used, either privately or through the board, to look at both the academic and to look at the IQ, and also, you know, whether it's essential to do both, look at the academic scores and at the IQ and what, how they differ?
Sure. And I mean, again, the WISC is just one measure of intelligence that, I mean, certainly it's a very popular one, but there are other highly standardized, well-developed other measures of intellectual functioning. And it's not, I mean, in most cases, it's not generally that the psychologist or psychological associate is trying to sort of, you know, generate one single IQ score. It's more to look at a profile of strengths and needs.
Right.
Because the standardized measures tend to look at verbal reasoning, nonverbal reasoning, aspects of possibly working memory or visual processing speed. There's a whole bunch of different kinds of indications that come up that give you a sort of a profile of strengths and needs, and that's what's particularly useful. Just as there are many different academic measures that can be used as well that are highly standardized. And typically, what is often being done is looking at how the thinking and reasoning abilities or the cognitive intellectual abilities sort of, you know, are related to the academic skill acquisition, how they can sort of predict or help us understand how the kids are developing in their learning skills.
So just to clarify, and I think you raise an excellent point that it's not just looking at the overall IQ of a child, but it's looking, as you said, it's looking at a profile. Because remind me, how many subtests are there in the WISC, for example?
Well, there are 10 core subtests that are typically used.
Right. So when a psychologist or a psych associate is doing the assessment, as you said, they're looking at strengths and weaknesses. So they're looking at the scores or how far the child is able to go, whether he reaches the norms in each of those subtests, right? Which, as you said,
it is normative. It is normed. So again, what you're always doing is comparing a child's performance to other children his or her age within a very close band, actually.
Right, which is what the standard
against a sort of the normal standardized peer group.
Right, and as you said, like those tests have been, you know, standardized and have been tested time and again to make sure that they are standardized.
Absolutely.
So parents shouldn't get hung up then on what their IQ of the child is. It's more about, and I think that's the benefit of doing a test like a WISC or anything else, any other test like it, is to look at strengths and weaknesses. So that, as you said, the teacher will sometimes recognize that something is amiss, something is not quite right, but they're not quite sure what. And so by doing these kinds of tests, they're able then to pinpoint where the weakness is, and then be able to focus in on that weakness and being able to help the child become stronger.
Absolutely, to understand why a certain task is so much more difficult for one child versus another, to sort of to understand that child's learning profile and how it relates to the daily life in the classroom.
And when the tester, such as yourself, is doing the assessment, what are some of the you're doing also the academic tests, right?
And I think that varies a little bit from board to board. I think typically I would like to see the children do some of the academic stuff as well. I like to sort of listen to them read. I like to see their written language. But in other boards, they may have a special education teacher or somebody else in the school do the academic side.
Right. And then again, in private practice, for example, I know that there are some psychologists who do the assessments themselves and other psychologists or psych associates who have other people do the formal assessment and then work with them in writing up the results.
That may be the case for some practitioners. Yeah.
But I guess there's something to be said for a psychologist doing his or her own assessment, only because there's probably some stuff that they're picking up while they're actually doing the testing too, right? It's not just about the scores, it's also about observing how long the child's able to sit and that kind of thing too, right?
And no matter who's, you know, actually sort of administering the items, the test, you know, the assessment items, the results are only interpretable within the context of what was going on at that time. Was the child focused? Was the child able to attend to what you were saying? Did the child, you know, again, you're in the room with the child. You want to see their approach to the different tasks.
Mm-hmm. That's why,
the numbers or the results are only meaningful within that context.
Absolutely. Same as if a child's first language at home is not English.
Absolutely.
And if you're administering an English standardized test that's English, then I guess the results wouldn't be that accurate, I would imagine.
Well, you're certainly interpreting them with much more caution.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, that's the reality for many of our students in our schools. So you can't, you know, sometimes you can't, you know, wait for very long. You know, you try to give them as much exposure to the time to adjust to a new language, a new culture, a new experience. But, you know, sometimes you have to go in there and do the best you can and interpret the results with a much more significant degree of caution and, you know, that's sort of what you say is the results are reasonable for this point in time, but you need to do some careful monitoring and a possible reassessment down the road.
How often would you reassess a child?
You know, that's a very difficult decision. I mean, it depends certainly on the needs of the child. Sometimes it doesn't happen for a number of years because the child is receiving the appropriate degree of service or the appropriate accommodations or modifications in the classroom, and the learning is continuing and sort of everything is going as expected and the teacher feels that it's a valid result. In other indications, the teacher or the parent will come back and say, you know, I think something's changed or something's different, and it's time to look again. Typically, the results, the younger the child, the less sort of length of time the results are valid for. So if you're assessing a 3-year-old, you would not in any way, shape, or form think that those results are valid when the child is 7.
Right. But I think there's a period of time that needs to lapse before a reassessment can take place, correct?
Typically. I mean, if you you look at the standardization materials or the test materials, they'll tell you really where the practice effects occur and what length of time you would expect. And that's the reason you want time to lapse is you don't want practice effects.
Can you just explain a little bit more what practice effects are?
Sort of like remembering what the items were, remembering things so that sort of it's not a fresh new look at the test item.
Right, so it wouldn't make the results as valid because they may remember that question right, from before and might have had time to look up the answer or something.
Yeah, or just
learn
sort of have more time to think about it than they might have in an assessment situation or have had, like you said, even potentially going and clarifying a response with an adult or something.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of after a child is assessed, what are some of the accommodations that might be put into place for that child?
And it varies, you know, obviously based on the result of the assessment. You know, sometimes no 3 children in the classroom who have, an assessment result will need the same thing. They might need dramatically different supports, which is why I always think we should, you know, take our hats off to teachers because there's one person and one adult in the room and trying to, you know, meet the learning styles of so many different children. But some of the supports might include extra time to complete tasks for children who may have some difficulty getting down to work independently or who may have some difficulty focusing and staying on task and completing work in a timely fashion. Certainly, there's a great deal of support now through assistive technology. There's 2 computer systems available in different schools. Sometimes you can have, there's text-to-voice supports available for kids. Sometimes somebody helps for children, again, with some of their written language difficulties. They may do a different type of presentation in the classroom, so an oral presentation or a diagrammatic representation of the information they've learned, or they may have someone scribe for them during a testing type of situation. Often there's preferential seating in the classroom for kids, again, who have difficulty staying on task and focusing. So the supports can vary depending on the assessment results and the needs of the individual child.
And can you describe a little bit about what an IPRC is?
An IPRC is an Identification, Placement, and Review Committee, and it's typically where sort of learning exceptionalities are formalized, and so the identification and the placement is more formalized. And the identification is typically in accordance with the Ministry of Education terminology, so a learning disability would be one of the ministry-approved exceptionalities, and the placement is typically related to the level of support available to the student in the classroom.
So if my understanding is correct, at the IPRC meeting, who would be present? There'd be parents, teacher?
Absolutely invited and encouraged to attend.
Mm-hmm.
A representative from the child's school, typically an administrator must come, a principal or a vice principal, often a classroom teacher or a special education teacher.
Right. So the IPRC meeting would take place after the child has been has received a diagnosis of a learning difficulty or disability, right?
After the child has had an assessment, typically, yes.
So regardless of whether he's been identified or not?
regardless of whether the child has been diagnosed or not?
Well, if the child is identified, is that when the IPRC would take place?
The identification happens at the IPRC.
Okay.
Like sort of the I in IPRC stands for identification.
Right, so that's when it's...
Which is different from a diagnosis.
Right. So, and then in terms of some of the accommodations, I know that sometimes some schools have specially contained classrooms where children can be withdrawn to receive extra help, correct?
They're typically through something like a resource classroom.
So what would happen in a resource classroom?
And again, this varies from school to school, depending on the needs of the school and depending on the resources available to that school. But typically, let's say for a block of time, a child may get some literacy support or some numeracy support or some, you know, support with their written language skills. And they may generally what happens is receive the instruction in the regular classroom, and they come out of and go into the resource room to complete an assigned task or to have possibly the lesson re-explained to them in a different way. That's one sort of level of support that can be available to students within schools.
And so there'd be less children in their classroom, obviously.
Yes, absolutely.
And then other times they stay in the classroom and then, as you said, just receive extra help.
Yeah, sometimes the special education teacher may come in to support the regular classroom teacher in the and work with a group of children in the classroom directly while in class.
I know that many parents are concerned about the stigma attached to being identified as a child with a learning disability. Do you think that other kids are aware of children being removed from the classroom, or how what's their perception of, do they get teased?
That's not been my experience. I mean, I have seen it happen. It's so, in most of the schools where I've worked, it seems very seamless. It's just part of the day. Kids come in and out for various reasons. They may come out to have, some speech and language support. They may come out for an occupational therapy session. They may come out to see the psychologist. They may come out to see the school social worker. There's so much sort of transitions during the day that it just seems to happen. And often, you know, kids who are not identified often come out for some support because they may be struggling with a specific concept. So they may come into the resource room for even just a brief period of time just to help them sort of master that concept. So it tends to go fairly smoothly and nicely for the children.
Go ahead. No, I was going to ask, do you think it's a good idea once a child has been diagnosed for a parent to actually give him the proper label for what's going on for him, in the same way as we encourage parents to kind of call body names by their proper names,
their proper label.
Yeah.
I think the best thing we can give our kids, especially, you know, those who have some learning needs, is the ability to advocate for themselves.
Right.
There are always going to be, you know, situations where someone may not understand their specific learning style or their need, and they're going to have to go in there, especially, you know, in the higher grades when they're dealing with multiple teachers, where they're going to have to go in there and say, you know, I don't understand it well when, you know, X, Y, and Z happens. I need A, B, and C to happen for me to understand this.
Right.
For me to show you what I know. So without having the understanding of their own learning style and their own learning profile, and without sort of having some of the appropriate terminology, it's very hard for kids to advocate for themselves.
Some parents are concerned that their older children especially will use the learning disability to their advantage, like, I can't do that because of... You know, do you have any ideas about how to get around that? Maybe it's...
I think, a bit of a challenge. I think that can be an issue sometimes from not even kids with learning disabilities. Sometimes I think, you know, you do have kids who sort of, we support almost a little bit too much, and you get a little bit of learned helplessness where they sort of are reticent to sort of pick up, you know, paper and pencil and get down to work independently without an adult sort of sitting nearby and guiding the process. And I think it's sort of a balance that we find between, you know, increasing the level of support when it's needed, backing away when it's not, realizing that, you know, all skills must develop, like any developmental skill, and learning to work hard and try hard is a developmental skill too. So it is, I think that's probably more child specific depending on what else, other things that may be going on.
And just in the same vein of thinking, I know that sometimes parents will misunderstand certain child's behavior and think it's something that it's not. For example, a lot of parents will say that he's very lazy.
Right, that's, yeah.
You know, and then when I've met with the parent and the child, something to me says this is beyond laziness. This is more, you know, this is not about laziness or lack of motivation. This may really be about the child not knowing how to even get started.
Not know what to do. And I mean, as adults, we have so much more control of our world. We don't do things we're not good at. Most of us, you know, if we're lucky enough, we're able to find jobs and employment where we're reasonably successful.
Right.
Kids get the curriculum delivered to them no matter whether they're good at it or not. They get the curriculum. And so for some kids, you know, reading is really, really hard. Well, you know, it's really, it's a very special child who will keep at it day after day when they're meeting with very little success.
Right. So if they're discouraged by not being able to do it, you're going to see that they're going to continue to decline somewhat because they'll become more and more discouraged as time goes on if they're having difficulty with it.
They become discouraged. They develop very well-established avoidance strategies to sort of deflect that attention off of them. Usually a fairly experienced teacher is pretty quick at saying, you know, there's something that needs further attention.
Right. But sometimes, as we both know, you know, teachers are, as you said, have so many needs to take care of. And I think my caution to parents always is, you know, if they're continuously seeing that their child just appears, you know, what they call lazy or unmotivated, that just to keep an open mind to the fact that it might be something other than that.
Absolutely. My sort of feeling is that kids want to do well. They want to do well at school. They would like to, you know, have the adults in the world sort of happy with them. And when they're not doing well at school, it's a big chunk of their lives. So, you know, I think that when they're not doing well, it does warrant further attention and investigation.
And spills over, as you said, into lots of other areas like self-esteem, self-confidence, peer relationships.
I repeatedly hear even about just, you know, parents bemoaning homework and the trial it can be to get it done every night for kids who have different learning styles.
Yeah, I think that that's a big one because I think parents, we talk about the classroom teacher being a great source of support, but I think as parents, that's where we see the difficulty emerge sometimes.
Absolutely.
Is when if you're finding that you're spending like 5 hours, or maybe that's an exaggeration, but you're spending 2 hours on something that should take 10 minutes.
Absolutely.
You know, your child keeps getting up to sharpen a pencil, or that, as you said, could be an avoidance strategy.
Absolutely. Or where you just, there's just sometimes the best, you know, phrase is just there's a disconnect. It just doesn't, the child seems so competent in other areas of his or her life and learns easily in, you know, in some areas. And like one of sort of the hallmarks of a learning difficulty is the really, you know, inconsistencies in their performance or the peaks and valleys.
Mm-hmm. And with the right support, can parents feel optimistic about their child developing the skills that they need to, or strengthening the weaknesses?
I think so. I think absolutely that skills continue to develop. The goal is ongoing development, continued development. And certainly, the post-secondary institutions have dramatically increased their understanding of the needs of different learners.
Yeah.
And kids go on to receive some of the same supports and accommodations at college and university.
Well, I think talking of that, my understanding is it's always a good idea to reassess just before high school. And I know that with the diagnosis of LD, or learning disability, children, as you said, can take part in, like they have a wonderful learning strategies program in grade 9 for children who have been diagnosed that I think all children should be able to have.
Because it's organizational skills, absolutely.
Yeah, because they, as you said, teach them organizational skills and a whole bunch of stuff, which I think is beneficial for all students, you know?
Sure, certainly. I think so, too.
So just in terms of, you know, we've talked a little bit about how parents may respond, but what's your experience with the way that parents may respond emotionally when they hear for the first time that their child has a learning difficulty?
It varies. Sometimes there's some anxiety around it, certainly a lack of, you know, being able to sort of predict what the child's future is going to look like. So, you know, sometimes they think, you know, does this change sort of their future, you know, their opportunities for post-secondary education? So there's sometimes a lot of fear and anxiety around it. Sometimes there can be some guilt around it when they feel that there's a family history and they wonder whether, you know, some of that's been passed on.
Mm-hmm. And I know firsthand with my older daughter having received the diagnosis of learning disability when she was young. I mean, she graduated from high school as an honors student, an Ontario scholar. And is now in an undergrad program at university and doing exceptionally well. So I know firsthand that doesn't mean that your doors are closed or that you can't do whatever you put your mind to.
Absolutely. And typically when I found, you know, in my experience, kids with you know, learning difficulties tend to actually do better as they go up the grades, where they get a little more choice and they can pick courses,
right,
programs of study in their areas of strength.
Right. I know for my daughter, for example, she has picked a career which requires her visual skills, or being able to recognize things visually.
Right.
And that's her strength. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, often you see kids who really blossom in high school and post-secondary.
Yeah. Yeah, that gives parents optimism, I think.
And working in, I can't say it often enough, but really working in close partnership with your child's teacher.
And what would that be like? Just keeping in touch, communication in the agenda, that kind of thing?
Yeah, supporting, you know, helping the child stay organized and helping with, you know, sometimes with time management, helping chunk the information at home into manageable units so that the child isn't overwhelmed and then just doesn't know where to start. Just, you know, keeping in sort of not necessarily daily contact, I don't think that's necessary, but sort of, you know, bi-weekly contact with the teacher. Is everything on track? You know, is there anything I need to be doing at home?
Mm-hmm.
Is what I'm seeing at home? You know, just sort of that ongoing communication where it's appropriate.
So, and other resources and supports that you can think of for you and your child? What have you come across?
Well, certainly there's a lot of information on the Learning Disabilities Association of Ontario, the LDAO website. You know, and it stands for the Learning Disabilities Association of Ontario. They have a lot of information for parents. There's some information nights. There's information on the assistive technology. The Integra agency in Toronto is also a wonderful resource that often deals with some of the other sort of ramifications of not necessarily having an easy time at school, some of the self-esteem impact, some of the social and emotional difficulties that may also warrant some attention.
And I think the Learning Disabilities Associations have different chapters throughout, correct?
Yes.
And I think, if I'm not incorrect, they have groups for both parents and children.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So
and they're very, from what I've heard from parents, very, very helpful.
Yeah, so both, whether you get information off their website or you attend their meetings, as you said, or educational.
They have newsletters that go out, online newsletters, and certainly I know some students and parents who took part in some summer institutes that they offered around the assistive technology.
That's the computers.
Yep, that's the computer programs that have, they allow sometimes, you can scan information into the computers and have them read to the child. So there's a lot of technology out there that supports the development of allowing kids to access the curriculum.
Yeah, I guess computers are an amazing give children who wouldn't otherwise have been able to write stories, for example, an opportunity to write it if their printing is illegible or they're having difficulty with fine motor.
Right, or if they just you know, get bogged down in the spelling.
Yes.
You know, sometimes I see kids who sort of simplify their written language because they don't know necessarily how to spell the word beautiful, so they'll write nice.
Yeah, exactly.
So the computer just opens up the whole world to them because it's so much easier to edit and to use the various functions to check your work.
Exactly. Anything that you can think that I haven't touched on that you'd like to add?
No, I mean, I think this is sort of just basically, you know, touching the surface of it. There's so much information out there online through your school, in different books, resource books around learning disabilities. It's not a simple concept because there are many different types of learning difficulties. It's just a very complex sort of issue.
Well, thank you. You have been a wealth of information, as I thought you'd be. So thank you so much, Helena.
It was a pleasure. It was nice talking with you.
And thanks to all of you for listening to this podcast. We hope you found the show informative. For more information about us and to learn more about the other free seminars that I'm hosting, visit helpmesara.com. Please subscribe and rate us on iTunes by searching for Help Me Sara. And Sara is spelled without an H, S-A-R-A. You can also send your questions, comments, and suggestions for future podcasts by emailing me at podcast@helpmesara.com, by tweeting me at @helpmesara, or if you're in the Toronto area, by calling me at 905-882-7690. Until next time.